Okay, well, welcome to the second meeting of the Legislative Reentry Work Group. Representative Paymar is not able to be here today, so I'll be chairing the meeting. I think there's a few people that are here kind of included in the working group that were not here at the first meeting. We're not going to have everybody go around the table and introduce themselves again, but I think the ones that are here today for the first time that are actually at the table on the working group that weren't here 2 weeks ago, if you could just maybe introduce yourself and maybe tell us a little bit about your interest in this. Do you want to start?
I'm Derek Davies. This identifies me as the Uniform Loss Commission. I'm on a committee in the Uniform Loss Commission that's working on the collateral consequences of a conviction of crime, which has to do with opening doors for housing and for opening doors for employment, and warning defendants a little bit about the consequences. But I'm a long time advocate of a parole board, and so I've been interested in that for a long time.
Okay.
I'm Ron Weiberg. I'm the head of the County Department of Community Corrections. Reentry is a very, very large issue for our department. We have a reentry program called the SCS Homes Program, which takes multiple felons out of prison, not just out of the workhouse, but out of prison, and teaches them to be carpenters. And we've run about 450 people through the program in 7 years, and our recidivism rate is just a touch less than 5%. So we're vitally interested in this. We're going to be expanding our program to the workhouse, which is our post-conviction facility, and involved in a lot of national stuff with our reentry program. So.
Sue? I'm Sarah Wolf. I'm the executive assistant to Susan Gertner, who regrets that she couldn't be here today and will be at future meetings, we hope. But obviously, when 90%+ of offenders are coming back into the community, this is an important issue. So, we're thankful to be here.
Okay, I think we'll get right started with testimony. I think as a result of the last meeting, as I recall, we decided we were going to focus in on two areas, particularly for the next few meetings anyway: housing and some kind of a parole board early release mechanism so that there would be some kind of a way for an inmate to be able to access a way to get back into the community quicker if it was appropriate. So today we're going to be focusing most of our discussion just on the housing issue, and we have Sherry Schoquist with us, and I don't know who you're...
Patrick Leary with
us. Oh, okay, you're Pat, okay. So I think we'll have Sherry first, and I think you were told about 10 minutes, but I think we can be liberal with that because we want to get a clear picture of the information that you're going to be bringing to us so we can have, I think, a productive, healthy discussion about how this could impact the issue that we're looking at here at reentry. So why don't you go ahead, Sherry, and then we'll take questions for you if we have a few just technical questions, and then we'll go to Pat after you.
Thank you, Chair Eastwind, and members of the Reentry Working Group. My name is Sherry Schoquist. I work at Minnesota Housing in the housing policy area. I am chair of the Minnesota Interagency Task Force on Homelessness, of which Pat Leary from DHS is a member, and so is Gary Johnson from the Department of Corrections. And I serve on the Minnesota Comprehensive Offender Reentry Planning Group with Gary. And reentry has been a priority for the Interagency Task Force on Homelessness for a few years, especially discharge planning. So on behalf of Minnesota Housing as well as the Interagency Task Force on Homelessness, it's an honor to be here today to present to you on housing needs for ex-offenders. This is Minnesota Housing's mission. You can read it for yourself. And our strategic goals, you'll note one of our goals is ending long-term homelessness, and I'll be talking about homelessness today. The majority of the slides that I've prepared for you are from Wilder Research. their information, data that was provided by Wilder Research in the 2006 Wilder Survey of People Experiencing Homelessness in Minnesota. I'm sure many of you are familiar with that. It's one of the best recognized statistically sound surveys on homelessness in the United States. The number of ex-offenders among the homeless population has been steadily increasing from 27% in 1997 to 47% in 2006. Almost half of homeless adults have been in jail or prison at some time in their life, and 17% have been released in the last 2 years. 70% of homeless ex-offenders were men. Compared to other homeless adults, they were more likely to have been in foster care, have served in the military, have received special education services, have alcohol and substance abuse disorders, have serious mental illness, cognitive disabilities, and symptoms of traumatic brain injury, be unemployed, and have lived in Minnesota at least 2 years. The population of ex-offenders varies among different types of shelter arrangements and includes 63% of adults in unsheltered locations. Now, when you're thinking of public safety, this means homeless adults, many of them released in the past 2 years from prison or jail, who have no known address. 54% of adults in emergency shelters, 53% of adults using informal shelters, 39% in transitional housing, which Pat Leary will talk more about today, and 29% of adults in battered women's shelters. This is information from the Wilder survey on Minnesota's recently released homeless ex-offenders, focusing on people who reported being released in the past 2 years from corrections, from jail, prison, or juvenile justice. And it's important to note that overall, 57% were homeless when they entered the facility. And 35% had a stable place to live at release from the facility. I'd also like to mention specifically Minnesota's long-term homeless ex-offenders. 50% of long-term homeless adults were reported being incarcerated, and 25% of long-term homeless adults report criminal history as a current housing barrier. This is something with Minnesota's business plan to end long-term homelessness and our implementation of that, that the Department of Corrections and Minnesota Housing and Department of Human Services, we're all working closely together to identify people that are being released from state prisons and connect them to housing and services in the community, especially if they're long-term homeless. Now, the definition of long-term homeless, I didn't provide it in the slide, but it's people that have been homeless for a year or more, or four times in 3 years. We're focusing on the hardest to serve with our plan to end long-term homelessness because those are people that haven't been accessing services and are 50% of the shelter population. That doesn't mean that if the social service or housing provider wanted to serve more than just offenders that are experiencing long-term homelessness, that they wouldn't be able to access Minnesota housing resources for that. We have a priority for projects that serve four long-term homeless families or individuals amongst, you know, the projects can be up to 40, they may be 16, they may be 10 units or services provided, but there is a priority for long-term homeless with our funding for that. But our other source of funds are available to serve all homeless. 5% of the agencies, or less than 5% of the agency's resources go to ending long-term homelessness. So we have a lot of other resources available for people wanting to serve offenders with affordable housing development. All right, so I just provided you an overview of the data, the information that we have from the Wilder survey that's homeless focused. I'm sure that Gary and other people at the Department of Corrections can provide kind of the other piece of the snapshot, you know, they will have information on people who are leaving prison, and with increased transitional services in prison, they could be able to provide other characteristics from that end of it. So what I provided you today from the housing need is what we know about people that whose housing needs aren't being met. And what we do know is that homelessness is prevalent among people released from prison and jail in Minnesota, just as it was found in a national report. I'm sure most of you are familiar, and I think some of you even participated in the forming of this report. But the report of the Reentry Policy Council, which was released in 2003, provides some national research highlights that I thought would be worthwhile to share with you today. In addition to homelessness being prevalent, the other findings are that there is insufficient affordable housing available to people coming out of prison. Of the affordable housing available, people with criminal records often are not eligible for it. Families can often provide housing, but doing so may risk the entire family's tenancy. Individuals released from prison who have a connection to stable housing may be less likely to be reincarcerated than their counterparts. I like how there's that one positive in the middle of all these other barriers. And transitional and supportive housing options may facilitate a successful reentry, but they are not available in sufficient supply. Just to reiterate the housing barriers for ex-offenders, public housing authorities, Section 8 providers, and other federally assisted housing programs are permitted or required to deny housing to individuals who have engaged in criminal activities that are drug-related, violent, or negatively affect the health and safety of other residents. This is just some requirements and policies for subsidized housing, but many landlords, of course, if they have 10 applications for one affordable rental unit, the person with a criminal history is not the likely person to have that unit rented to them. And then a short slide on some recommendations for reentry housing for offenders. The main thing we know that works is housing with support services. Now, that can be supportive housing, as I've been discussing, or transitional housing, or it can be something as simple as rental assistance combined with typical parole or probation-type services. Prison or jail-based transitional planning services are provided through or in coordination with supportive housing. That would be reentry housing, which is similar to supportive housing, but focused on ex-offenders. Some really fabulous examples of housing with support services in Minnesota are Alliance Apartments, and Dan Kane is here, and I'd rather have him speak about his program than me, so hopefully he'll be willing to answer some questions. But that is on-site housing that is not targeted specifically to bless you people coming out of prison, but has a very good program to serve people coming out of prison and jail. And St. Stephen's in Minneapolis, which provides rental assistance and assistance finding housing, and then what we call interference or tenancy support services with landlords. They have a program where they've reached out to many landlords and said, take a chance with this person. We know he has this history. We'll provide security deposit and first month's rent, and we'll be there that you can call if there's any problems. And then they help them find the housing and help them access employment and other income. And then I also have to mention MCORP, or the Minnesota Comprehensive Offender Reentry Plan pilot, which is kicking off now or soon in Hennepin, Ramsey, and oh, Gary, I think my PowerPoint here is the one who's from Olmsted County here. So Olmsted County is actually three counties, and I did have this corrected but pulled up the wrong one. It's Olmsted, Dodge, and Fillmore County.
Yeah, it's actually DFO.
Okay, Fillmore Northeast.
Okay, is it...
Right.
Oh, good. I'm so glad. At least I got it half right.
Yeah.
I just don't want to offend any counties that are doing really good work. So those are some examples of what works.
Could I just ask one little clarification on this slide?
Mm-hmm.
The St. Stephen's example, how is that funded?
It's funded from a mixture of sources, like every housing program is. One of the main sources of funding is Family Homeless Prevention Funds, which come from Minnesota Housing to Hennepin County, and then Hennepin County has granted funding to St. Stephen's. The Family Homeless Prevention Program funding was doubled at the legislature this last biennium, and so there's an opportunity for increased outreach to offenders with those funds. However, each grantee sets local priorities, and their local advisory board determines the best use of funds in their region or county. And with that, that's my contact information. Dan has a question, and then I'd like to let you know what else I provided in your packet.
Jerry, I see just for clarification on the slide about recently released as homeless. So 35% of the people who are currently homeless that have criminal records had a stable place to go when they were actually released from prison, is that correct?
Right, and this is self-reported from the Wilder survey.
So there's no objective criteria which determines stable, it's just whatever they said?
Right, and so, you know, stable could mean, you know, they own a home.
Girlfriend's house.
Or it's their girlfriend's house and her tenancy could be at risk because they're there having a criminal record or not being included on the lease.
That was going to be my next question. Is in terms of the Wilder survey, do they have any data on the families that became homeless because an offender moved back into the family setting and rendered them ineligible for their housing, either in public housing or HUD-supported housing?
My gut reaction is I don't believe so, but it's something that I could certainly look at and provide you information with. Speak to Greg Owen at Wilder. But I don't remember any questions specifically getting at that. It sounds like a great research project for illegal services.
How often it happens? How frequently it happens?
Anything I say would be probably biased since I used to working for legal aid in North Minneapolis and was in housing court for 7 years. And so, and the question of how often it happens that families are evicted because offenders move in. Well, if I was representing them, hopefully they weren't. But I know there were many. You know, I think speaking to someone from Minneapolis Public Housing Authority or St. Paul Public Housing Authority or Section 8 landlords would be able to give you a much bigger picture. It is a huge issue, and especially, Pat will talk more about this with transitional housing, but I think people forget offenders are part of families. They have children, and it's something that needs to be taken in consideration with the big picture with, okay, yes, there was a criminal activity and we want our public housing to be safe. But we also want our families to be stable and we want our offenders to stay in the community and feel a vested part of the community instead of reoffending. And so they're not easy issues to consider, but they're important too.
Sherry, could you give us a sense for the history of the Wilder Research Survey, how it started, why it started? Because I think as it's progressed from year to year, or every 3 years, more information about corrections clients have come forward. It's just kind of naturally come to their attention. Am I right about that?
Yes, and thank you for giving me an opportunity to encourage you all to consider funding the Wilder Survey from state appropriations. Pat Pat Leary can speak more about it. He was one of the original members of the Interagency Task Force on Homelessness, which has been around since 1993. And one of our main activities is promoting and funding, supporting the Wilder Survey. Greg Owen from Wilder Research is the person that should be answering this question. But what I can say is it started in 1991. It occurs every 3 years. I mentioned earlier that it's nationally recognized. Our survey is one of the best, if not the best, survey on homelessness in the United States. And in the past two Wilder surveys specifically, Wilder Research has provided a report on offenders. And Gary and his staff at Corrections has assisted in formulating the questions and getting the questions asked. Now, Dan's question, I wish the survey had included that, but we want to keep it at 100 questions so people can stand to get through it in a half an hour, 45 minutes. But it is an excellent survey that we use to guide policy not only at Minnesota Housing but across over 10 state agencies. Pat, do you
want to
add anything?
Just to give you a on-the-street snapshot of the Wilder survey, I mean, the way it works is they recruit hundreds of volunteers, and all the surveys take place, or most of the surveys take place on one night, the survey night, and you go out and cover all the programs in the state, and the volunteers sit down across the table from a person staying at a shelter, a transitional housing program, and ask them a battery of questions that lasts about 40 to 45 minutes. And respondents are given $5 for answering the questions. But my experience with it is that you find out more about homeless people in that survey than you find out about your best friends in 10 years. It's a very detailed survey, and Wilder is always trying to make it better and to get at answering the questions that we have. But my experience with it is that most of the people who I've interviewed are thankful that they've had a chance to tell their story at the end of it. So it's a very comprehensive and credible survey.
You can find a wonderful overview on wilderresearch.org. And I'll read you a sentence from an introduction to the overview that's about the study. It says, every 3 years since 1991, Wilder Research has conducted a statewide survey of people who are homeless or living in temporary housing programs. In October 2006, more than 950 volunteer interviewers conducted face-to-face interviews with over 3,700 people experiencing homelessness. Interviews took place throughout Minnesota in about 250 emergency shelters, transitional housing programs, and battered women's shelters, and among homeless people not in shelters. Over the past two surveys, in 2006 and 2003, we had a tremendous effort to interview people living on the streets and people living in, unsheltered conditions. And especially in Hennepin and Ramsey County, the street outreach has been fabulous, and we've gotten really good information on the experience of people who aren't staying in the shelter system. Anything else? Yeah.
I don't know if anybody would address this. On page 3 of your handout, 70% of the homeless sex offenders were men. I'm assuming that means 30% in women, but it seems to me that's an awful large number given the number of women who are released every year. I guess, Dennis, or somebody, it can't be more than 10%, is it?
I don't know how that number breaks down in terms of our releases. We do about 6,000 releases a year, but what percent is female versus male? I don't have that up in my tongue.
I think it's about 6% who are female, who are incarcerated. Six. Yeah.
I know among.
To follow up then, I don't see here, I'm assuming there are kids involved in all of this.
Right. Among long-term homeless, Families make up about a fourth of that population, and so this my gut reaction again is this data sounds correct. There is the shelter counts in interviews. I think it's a bit complicated for me to give you a women versus men breakdown, but that is consistent with families versus individuals homeless numbers, and I could get back to you with that information if needed.
Could you comment on the scope of the insufficiency of affordable housing? The Guidelines Commission's been hearing a group on collateral sanctions in employment and similar folks, the same folks, obviously. And a thing that strikes me whenever we're having these policy discussions is if the reality is that, or that another way is that maybe the foundational reality is we need to get this housing built. And one of the reasons that I think we ought to hear more about the program that Ron Weiberg talked about is that it does suggest a way to link offenders who need work experience to creating housing in the communities that they come from and to which they return. And I know a lot of you are aware that the guidelines or that the Collateral Sanctions Committee sponsored a legislative event, which was a complete bust, partly because it occurred at 9 o'clock the day after the legislature had been here till 3 a.m. in a special session. But that was the point. I mean, we may really need some bigger ideas if we're going to provide adequate housing. I guess I wasn't supposed to make a speech at this point. We've had some difficulty getting a sense of what the shortage is. Do you have a sense of the scope of that?
I think I could provide your working group with Minnesota Housing's affordable housing plan for the biennium that will give you all the information you need on our understanding of the scope of the need for affordable housing. And I'd rather just provide you with that data than to go by memory here today. But I think with offenders especially, it just goes to that example that I told you earlier, explained earlier. If a landlord has 10 applications or 20 applications for one affordable apartment, the offender is going, or the, you know, the family that has criminal history in their family is going to be, you know, at the bottom of the list for renting that apartment. And then it puts that family in the neighborhoods where landlords will rent to families with criminal history in their background. And, you know, it affects the whole family stability, including educational opportunities and housing that's near work and, you know, other employment. So it's affordable housing is a huge issue in general, and especially for offenders.
We should maybe, could we just hold the rest of our questions and we can let Pat...
Can I explain what the other...
Okay, sure. Why don't you finish your comments and then we'll move on.
The PowerPoint broke out information that you can read firsthand from Wilder Research. It's provided this handout, Homeless Ex-Offenders. There's also a map at the back that provide somewhat of a geographical distribution of people experiencing homelessness in Minnesota. The other two documents that I provided are from the Reentry Policy Council. There's a two-page fact sheet entitled Homelessness and Prisoner Reentry that gives information nationally but focuses on our program, Alliance Apartments, here in Minnesota. Thank you, Dan Kane. And I also provided, it doesn't state that this is from the Reentry Policy Council, but it's a large chart from their report that talks about the differences in types of housing, whether it's private market rental housing or supportive housing or transitional housing or halfway housing, listing the features, the benefits, and the potential limitations for ex-offenders. I thought that might be helpful for your discussion in the latter part of the agenda today. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, Ms. Shorquist. Pat, why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself, and you can make your comments now.
Okay. Representative Eastland and working group members, thank you for giving me the opportunity today to speak with you on this issue. My name is Pat Leary, and I'm with the Minnesota Department of Human Services, and I'm a homeless program specialist. I've worked with the department for 22 years, specifically on the homeless program, primarily with shelter and transitional housing. As Sherry mentioned, 47%, it just astounds me, 47% of the shelter and transitional housing population are ex-offenders or are connected to an ex-offender. And so, you know, obviously homeless people who are ex-offenders are accessing those programs. I think that transitional housing is a good vehicle for ex-offenders to try to get reintegrated back into both into housing and into employment for the following reasons. The way transitional housing works is the program can vouch for the ex-offender. In other words, they can enter into the lease agreement with the landlord on behalf of the ex-offender. So that gives the landlord some ease in that they know that if things don't work out right with their tenant, that they can go back to the program and ask for some remedial help. Transitional housing programs also may go to landlords and negotiate with them, basically saying, take a chance on this person. If this doesn't work, you can hold us responsible. So in some instances, maybe even the ex-offender can enter into that or sign that lease agreement. And that's essential because ex-offenders obviously have difficulty going to a landlord and signing a lease. It's getting back to the Wilder survey, 2 years ago I was sent out to or assigned to Victory House in St. Cloud, which is a transitional housing program, and it specifically targets ex-offenders. And I maybe did 8 different surveys, and it was person after person who said, I've got a felony on my record, no one will rent to me, and virtually no one will employ me. And where do you go from there? So, transitional housing it doesn't get the felony off the record necessarily, because transitional housing is only 2 years in length. But it does at least give them a track record, so they've got a better shot when they go back to into the rental market on their own of being able to find a place to live and sign a lease agreement.
You got a question or a comment right now?
What exposure of the landlord are you covering? Property damage, non-payment, tort liability?
The formal, the program will cover I think more specifically property damage. I'm not sure what they do beyond that, but I think many times it's even more informal. It's there's someone to call when something isn't going right. So if it's 9 o'clock in the evening and there appears to be something wrong going on in that property, there's a program person to call who then intervenes immediately. And I think that provides the landlord with the assurance so that they're willing to take that risk. I could get back to you more if you have more specific. Each program is a little bit different, so there's no one answer to that question. But
one thing I could add too is I know neighborhoods and communities where they are pleased to know that a social service organization is involved in a particular problem property. They may feel that the owner of the property is absentee or unresponsive. Sometimes the properties are at risk of being condemned because of criminal activity, and there are neighborhoods that are pleased to have social service organizations like St. Stephen's involved and helping to manage those properties and get people in there that will abide by the law, mm-hmm. hopefully.
Another small caveat is I've had conversations with Gary Johnson from the Department of Corrections through our interagency task force, because Gary presented on the Department of Corrections transitional housing program. And I just wanted to explain what I understand is the difference, and Gary can certainly chime in on this, but the Department of Corrections has some funding available to provide some reentry housing, but I believe it's different from what the Department of Human Services is doing in this respect. As Gary informed me, the primary purpose of that the Department of Corrections transitional housing is really a public safety concern, and that is more keeping track of your most egregious, likely to reoffend persons coming out of institutions. Whereas with the Department of Human Services, I think we're certainly focused on rehabilitation. You know, we're recruiting people who we think are going to be successful in being able to and show the interest in living independently and becoming employed.
I'll just say, Pat, that you were educational for us with the Department of Corrections in our housing program. When we use the word transitional, there's an actual definition of transitional housing, and we were using that term really to mean more transitioning from prison to a housing location so you can get yourself on your feet and move on. It's really temporary housing that we're providing as opposed to transitional housing as it's defined. So we don't call it transitional housing anymore, but our housing is temporary housing, and it's temporary emergency housing for offenders, and I can get into that a little later if the group wants me to.
And I didn't mean to say that is one's better than the other. There's certainly room for and purpose for both. But I think we're serving a little bit different population there. I guess the last thing I'd like to say is that, as a fallback, as a necessary evil, is the shelter system. And we also fund the shelters. And when nothing else is available, hopefully the shelter is there for people to at least have a warm place to stay. And I know many of the shelters are beginning, the shelter system has been in place since, the early 80s, and as time goes on, shelters are becoming much more transitional focused. They're trying to help people through crises also, not just provide a hot and a cot as it used to be. So many of our shelter programs, too, are now kind of focused on trying to address people's needs and trying to find a long-term solution for people who are staying there, including the ex-offender. So, take questions at this time.
I've got a couple of things I'd like you to comment on, or maybe Dennis, maybe this is for you to comment on. We're kind of coming at the ex-offender from the homeless side here. What we see in the homeless community. If you were going to come at it from the relief side, how many ex-offenders actually experience homelessness in the first couple of years after leaving the prison system? What percentage of the outgoing population?
I think I can mention, I think we're at about a quarter of those people released who have homelessness to face when they're planning their release. They don't have anywhere to go.
Isn't it still the case that Ken Tancuri and the Dorothy Day Center are the two most occurring addresses for offender releases within the city of Minneapolis and St. Paul?
Yeah, I think you're right. I think I heard at one point that 10% of those offenders released to Hennepin County were released to
1010.
The homeless shelter at 1010 Curry.
What percent?
About 10%.
10% of all?
Of all releases going back to Hennepin County.
And what percent of the releases go to Hennepin County?
I think it's around 22%, somewhere in that.
Almost a quarter.
Yeah.
The other issue there, of course, is if you compare that population to those that are released to a stable home or environment, the recidivism statistics are glaringly different as well.
That was kind of the second question that I had is there's multiple how many offenders that are released have these multiple factors where they might face homelessness, they're chemically dependent, they have some kind of a mental impairment. What percentage of the group that are leaving prison have multiple indicators, and then when we get into the homeless population, is it a similar demographic, or do people with multiple problems really congregate when they get to the homeless site?
I don't think that we track a percentage that we could give you that have multiple issues. We've got some statistics that say that upwards of 80 to 90% of our offenders in prison are chemically dependent or chemically abusive, and about a quarter of the male population in our prison are in need of psychotropic medications. That's only those that need medications. There's probably many others who have mental health issues that don't require medication.
Mm-hmm.
The female population is more like 40% who require psychotropic medication. So many of those offenders have co-occurring issues here that they're dealing with, and it's, I think, similar in characteristics for the homeless population. They all almost always have some kind of condition that presupposes why they're homeless. They're either chemically dependent or mentally ill or both.
We do track the serious persistent mentally ill that we release. I don't know that number, but I can get that. We do discharge planning with those people. So I think that category in and of itself, we probably do a better job of tracking with our discharge planners than we do the rest of our population. We've been able to get some funding for some positions to manage those people and try to find an appropriate placement for them when they're released. We work with the counties, of course, and agents to find some type of housing arrangement.
If I could, I feel the need to mention that mental illness is one of the biggest problems for people that are homeless, especially long-term homeless, and whether they're being released from a hospital or a mental hospital or the Department of Corrections, there are high percentages of people with serious and persistent mental illness or serious mental illness in emergency shelters. And for the ex-offenders that report a serious or persistent mental illness from the Wilder survey is 59%. So of people experiencing homelessness with a mental illness that were released from either jail or prison in the last 2 years, 59% report having a mental illness. And when you talk to the staff, whether it's at Dorothy Day or 1010 Curie or another shelter, they'll say it's more like 90-95%, but that's, you know, they're not doctors and it's not self-reporting, but it's believed to be much, much higher.
One other comment. I was looking in the Wilder report here. Senator Higgins had a copy of it so I could look at it when you were talking here. But there was one thing that kind of struck me as being interesting under this category of barriers to employment. It's on page 11 of the copy I've got. But it was interesting because I've always thought in my head that housing was one of the largest barriers to employment. Now, this is self-reported, so there's nothing scientific about this. But really, the biggest barrier to employment is lack of transportation, according to this one. And then housing, and 27% report that. And then physical health problems and mental health problems. So and actually, they're all pretty statistically similar: 27%, 26%, and 24%. And I guess the housing piece is a critical piece, but it's clearly related to a lot of other things. But I thought the other interesting was with transportation because somehow I think the housing or what we're talking about today and as it relates to employment is really kind of a 1-2 punch. I mean, if you can create some kind of stability and housing is maybe at the center of that, then you can create maybe an environment that somebody could be employed. But housing is just one of the pieces, and it clearly shows, at least in the self-reporting here, that they also need the services of mental health issues, chemical dependency issues, and other things that go along with that. But anyway, you got a question here? Somebody else. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, I've always had kind of a keen sense for the obvious, so let me make an observation based on 4 or 5 comments. 6,000 released each year, about a quarter of them homeless, but the top release location in Hennepin and Ramsey are homeless shelters, which is on top of that, which would mean that we're close to about 2,000, I would think, homeless offenders entering into the community each year. And then if I could follow it up with a question, to Pat, would you characterize the inventory of transitional housing in Minnesota to be larger or smaller than it was, say, 10 years ago? And if it's smaller, are there reasons other than the lack of money that have caused some of what we used to count on for transitional housing that has gone away?
I would, using my memory, but I believe the number of programs has actually grown in the past 10 years. I think a recent trend, maybe in the last 2 to 4 years, has been a shrinkage in some programs, and it's based on funding, and it's programs that provide scattered site housing. So, your congregate, we have basically 2 kinds of transitional housing programs. Congregate, which is a building which has X number of units in it, and then the other type is scattered site, where the program goes out and rents properties based on the amount of funding they have. And so we've seen a little bit of the funding hasn't, due to federal policy, which has really come down hard on transitional housing as opposed to it's favoring more longer-term housing now. And the state funding has... We've got small percentage increases in the past 2 legislative sessions, but I think by and large we're really at a it's somewhat stagnated in the last 2 to 4 years in terms of the capacity of what we're able to provide. So, but overall, there's still a lot of activity. I still hear going around the state and listening to the planning groups on how to deal with homelessness. And seeing the applications we get for our funding, many of which we're not able to fund, there's still a growth in the number of transitional housing programs in the state.
Is the demand greater, though, Pat, now than in previous years?
The demand, it's a little bit hard to measure. We can look at the number of turnaways from programs, and on a given, we do a survey out of our office. Now it's done, it used to be done quarterly, now it's done once every 6 months. And we count, we ask programs to report the number of turnaways from programs, and that's steadily growing, and it's somewhat leveled off, but it's at about 1,000 households per night that are, now that's, I have to say there's some duplication there, because obviously a household can go to one program, get on a waiting list, and then search other programs. So we're not able to unduplicate that number, but just comparatively speaking, we've done this survey since 1985, that's at all-time highs. It's somewhat leveled off in the past 10 years as far as turnaways, but it's still kind of it's still going up little by little.
Yeah.
Well, and this kind of a statement and a question along with it, I guess, but kind of the elephant in the living room, the people that are most difficult to house are the people that public policy would suggest that we're most afraid of, and that's sex offenders. And do you have any data on those homeless people that were ex-offenders that were released in the past 2 years by crime category?
Because this is self-reported and it's 100 questions done by volunteers and, you know, a half an hour to 45 minutes, we don't get into that much detail in the Wilder survey. But I think that working with the Department of Corrections or some of the MCOR pilot counties, we might be able to obtain some of that data. It's a good question.
The point is a homeless sex offender is probably more of a threat to us than a homeless shoplifter. I'll just say that the department's housing program really sprung out of a realization that we were releasing sex offenders to homelessness at an alarming rate back in the early 2000s, and we studied that a little bit and went to the legislature after that study was done and got an appropriation of $1.37 million for offender housing to try to stem this homeless trend. And it was really driven by the notion that there were sex offenders who were going to be released to our communities who we weren't going to be able to adequately supervise because we didn't know where they were. And so our housing was funded because of, I think, some concern about that issue. We, at this point in time, after a couple of years of having our temporary housing in place, have about 37% of our population that goes to our offender housing, our sex offenders. So it's not, it's a significant percentage for sure, but it's also indicative of the pervasiveness of this homeless problem for corrections clients, that there are another 63% of those people we put in our housing who aren't sex offenders who have the same problem.
It's a bit of a sideways turn, so why don't we finish up this conversation?
I was just going to add to that an observation from my perspective. I was talking with our hearings and release unit this week, and I think we're looking at bringing in 65 release violators in a week. And I think the other thing we do, and this is something we do to ourselves, and I think it's part of this whole hysteria around sex offenders in particular, but we are violating people for reasons today that I don't know that we did 10 years ago. And some of those people, anyway, may be in a stable home or an environment because they didn't report on time or they had been restructured once and we weren't going to restructure them again. But anyway, then we bring them back to prison, take them out of that home.
Now they're homeless.
Bring them back to our environment for 30 days, 60 days, 90 days, and then we start all over again. So my point is, I don't want to overlook the notion that we might be part of the problem too, just in terms of this turn, the constant in and out. I mean, the turnover of these released offenders, I think, has reached a critical point. As we're bringing them back, we're doing virtually little or nothing for them in prison for that period of time, and then we start the process over. And I don't know that public safety is being well served by bringing somebody back to prison for 60 days and then starting all over. It costs a lot of money, takes a lot of the agent's time, takes a lot of our casework time, and we're right back to where we were probably 6, 8, 9 months before. So I think as a system, that's something that we're looking at. We're really focusing on these release violators, and many times they come to jail for 3, 4, 5 days, and they're restructured there, but they might lose a job, they might be late on their rent, so I don't even know that we're doing the right thing by restructuring. And I need to say that even 10 years ago, we weren't as hysterical about... We've overcorrected, is the bottom line. We have overcorrected in response to some high-visibility cases. And I think the net is just too big, and we've got to get back to a point where these people that still have a shot of making it out there, I mean, we've got all kinds of gadgetry today that we didn't have 10 years ago. We have bracelets, we have home electronic monitoring, we have intensive supervised release. I think there's management tools that we can keep them in the community, connected to that lease, still going to that job, without saying, sorry kid, you're going back to the joint, you screwed up one too many times. Because these people, you know, it's tough to, you know, we talk about reentry, but reentry really is tough for offenders to go from this very confined, controlled environment back to an alarm clock and some personal responsibility, and that takes time. It just takes time for these people. And on the other hand, where we have all of those things in place, and I keep referring to the challenge incarceration model, where they have that job, they're released sober, they have excellent supervision, they have a place to live, and they have pretty darn good supervision out there, it seems to work much, much better. And as Gary said, these people that were kind of, you know, releasing them to these addresses that we know are trouble.
At some point we're gonna break and actually go to the questions here on the next part of our agenda. So.
I think as long as, you know, we're in the confessional mode, I must say that, you know, I think on behalf of judges, I would have to say the same thing. We have the analogy or the analog for judges is probation revocation decisions. The commission has pointed out in its data that Minnesota has more admissions for probation violations and supervised release violations than is generally true in the United States. And I must say that I certainly feel that I contributed to this difficulty, and I wouldn't confess if I thought I were alone. I mean, I don't think I was an outlier. The fact is that in the 21st century, we have a lot of information about ways that we can manage these probation decisions and probation cases to increase success. There are too many occasions when, you know, if we focus on recidivism, we would make different decisions. I put some kid on probation for assault or for armed robbery. He is not somebody who's been particularly functional, as I define functionality. I value this person, so I say I want the same thing for him that I would want for my own kids, which includes sobriety, getting up in the morning to go to work or go to school, etc., and so forth. The chances are very, very high that this young man is going to disappoint me. so, you know, the first time he's not keeping in touch with his probation officer, he comes to court. Then he is put into a structured setting like Eden, and he doesn't wash the dishes there, and he gets kicked out of there. And then in the treatment program, he was not compliant, whatever. But a year and a half has gone by, and he hasn't done any crimes either. And somehow our repertoire has not included responses for noncompliance that are less destructive than and costly than taking that individual then, when I finally get fed up with him, which is on number 3 or 4 or something, and sending him to prison. And, you know, I do think we need to have more discussion about, in the crime response complex, if you will, about how do we deal with violators who are not recidivating, you know, because I think if we focus on the notion of recidivism, we provide the same kinds of services that we're talking about here, because recidivism is prevented by all these supportive services to the right people. But we have a much better measure of what we're doing. You know, if I were to define success as preventing recidivism as opposed to rehabilitating this young man so he looks more like my own kid, you know, we might have a whole different notions of what success is that would be a lot less destructive and a lot less costly.
Senator, maybe you can make your comments and we're going to jump into the last
thing. I wanted to go back to the mental health issue for a minute. And Ron Weiberg and I worked really hard this year to get a change in public policy so that when people come out of their incarceration time, their access to prescriptions and such have just been suspended and not totally terminated. And I was wondering whether anybody had any notion of whether that was helping, whether it's working. Is it too early to ask, Ron?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Higgins, yeah, it's a little bit early to ask. It just kicked in August 1st. And one other note on that is that when the bill passed its final stage, in addition to those people held in county jails, it also applies to people held in prison less than 1 year. I might add as a sidelight here that the state of New York legislature just passed a law within the last couple of weeks that says anybody in prison, regardless of how long they're in there, if they're eligible before they went in, nothing changed while they're in prison, so the day they get out, they're back on.
That should really help with some of the issues that we have heard about so much, you know, about going out, trying to find a home, trying to get stable, trying to get a job, trying to find some transportation, evidently, mm-hmm. and getting 4 or 5 days worth of meds. And
it does cancel out one of those barriers that's always been there. But then the other thing that we've got to look at, too, is that this law that was passed saves counties a tremendous amount of money. In Minnesota, we're talking millions of dollars are going to be saved in local tax levy. And it was all done at no additional cost to the state or the Fed. Mm-hmm. So theoretically, we're freeing up some financial resources for it, too. Let's go on to item 4 on the agenda. A couple of questions to get us thinking about solutions. I think we know there's a problem, and maybe we can see it a little more clearly today after the discussion. But let's just take a look at the two questions that we've kind of got on the agenda. What is the biggest challenge for ex-offenders when they are coming out, attempting to find housing? What can we do from a policy perspective? What are the issues that we have to actually address so we're going to change the outcomes? Do we have any insights into that, and can we just discuss that for a little bit and see what ideas we've got out on the table?
Well, I can give you a whole laundry list. How much time do you have? one of the biggest barriers, I mean, obviously there's a shortage of transitional housing, and there's probably a shortage of appropriate transitional housing. And by that, what I mean is, for instance, Pat talked about scattered sites. We don't do scattered sites because you know, because number one, the folks that we deal with don't necessarily respond well to it. Number two, it doesn't allow for the maximization of supervision and support services that the type of program that we operate, which we refer to as an intentional community as opposed to congregate living, allows. And yet zoning regulations make it very difficult to create intentional communities. Most municipalities have an agreement that if you have more than four unrelated adults within one dwelling, you have to have a conditional use permit. Mm-hmm. And even though from a best practices standpoint, it may make sense to put, you know, 10 offenders or 15 offenders in one site where you can maximize your supervision, getting someone to say, you can build that next to my house where my kids live, is a real challenge. And that's a conflict. It will always be a conflict as long as we have the zoning situations that we have. Another problem is the use of criminal background checks, the records, and so on and so forth. And some of the subsidies that we have in place to help people gain access to housing actually prohibits people with criminal background checks from accessing them. For instance, all of our projects have Section 8 support through what we call unit-based housing, unit-based Section 8 certificates. And yet, you know, certain people are not qualified because of their crime to qualify for a Section 8 certificate. Furthermore, HUD has a definition of homelessness that includes living on the street, couch hopping, living in transitional housing and having to leave, but it doesn't include leaving jail. You know, it specifically excludes leaving jail. So leaving jail without a place to go does not qualify you as homeless for HUD. And I realize that's a federal program, not a state program, but it's something that should be addressed. At the state level, and Sherry, I promise not to attack the definition of long-term homelessness here. But we've had this discussion before. But we have a situation where our definition of long-term homelessness does not include certain things that I believe it should include relative to people being released from prison. For instance, it does include, if you met the definition of long-term homelessness when you went in, you're still long-term homeless when you come out, which is a good thing. But if you were homeless when you went in and you don't come out for 5 years, you still don't qualify as long-term homeless because you got to have 12 months homeless on the street. I would argue that 5 years in prison is pretty homeless when the state's taking care of you, but that's, you know, that's a personal argument. The other thing is, if you leave the institution after all efforts have been made by your case manager and your caseworker to try and find you a stable place to live, I would argue that you qualify as homeless. If you have no place to go, you should be homeless. If you leave the institution with a crime that requires you to register, I think that that should be taken into consideration in the definition of homelessness. And absent fitting corrections people in the existing definition of long-term homeless, I think that we should look to creating a separate category that addresses released offenders. Now, having said that, we did that in a way, and the state has a tendency to do this, but we did this in a way when we gave Gary $1.3 million and we said, go find people places to live. What we did is we reinvented the wheel. I mean, we've got a subsidy program at MHFA. We've got people at MHFA that know how to find housing. We got, you know, a system in place at MHFA that has gone through the learning curve to how to do this right. But we didn't want to do offenders through MHFA. So what we did was we gave $1.3 million to corrections, and we said, you go figure out how to do it. Get on that learning curve, go through that process, find all those landlords, understand all, you know, and that just wasn't a real efficient way to do it. So if we do look to providing some subsidy or something for homeless offenders, recognizing the prevalence that they are amongst our homeless population, I would hope that we leave it in the MHFA and give it to the MHFA as opposed to giving it to the Department of Corrections to reinvent the wheel. And that you guys do a real good job reinventing the wheel, but I just don't think that it makes sense. You know, some other things that we have landlord liability for some crimes. If you're a landlord and you rent to a known felon who had a controlled substance crime, you run the risk that if that person were to return back to drug dealing, you can be held liable for that. I mean, isn't that correct, Kevin? I mean, your housing can become at risk for it, I believe.
I think we've got a few.
You know, it's like negligent hiring problems for employers. Well, if I know by renting to you, if you reoffend, I stand to lose my rental housing, I'm not going to rent to you. I mean, that's something that needs to be examined as one of the collateral consequences that we've got into place. The other thing, that the subsidies that exist out there in some ways enslave people, and this goes beyond just the ex-offender, but the HUD subsidy, the long-term homeless subsidy, you know, the way we set these things up, we set them up so that there's really not a lot of incentive to get off of them. If you get a job, if you become self-sufficient, the subsidy goes away, you have to pay 100%. And that holds true for HUD, it holds true for GA, it holds true for SSDI, it holds true for the long-term homeless subsidy. I think that we need to look at ways that we can make our entitlement programs or our subsidy programs, particularly as they relate to able-bodied people, declining in nature with an incentive for them to move towards self-sufficiency more than it has been in the past. And then the other issue is the whole, and I keep bringing it up, the whole issue of sex offenders. As long as the zoning laws are in place the way that they are, now Gary can get whoever he contracts with to go out and rent a building where they house four people and slide under the conditional use permit radar until such time as the community finds out about it, and then they go absolutely bonkers on you. And, you know,
I want a rebuttal.
Yeah. Well, just let me say Rochester. But
that's why I want a rebuttal.
but you know, we have to find a way where we can do what it's right to do in the light of day. You know, I'm very, very humbled and honored by the fact that people have talked about the Alliance Apartments, and we've got it in this thing here as an example of a good project. But the fact of the matter is, that project is, you know, there's honest and then there's honest. I mean, we do what we call sober supportive housing. That's what we do. Now, if we were to take that to the next level and say, who moves into sober supportive housing? You know, people who are coming out of jail and people who've been drunk or been loaded or whatever and don't want to continue doing it. So really what we have by extension is offender housing and housing for people who have come out of treatment. It works very well. But if we were to go to the community and say we want to build offender housing and housing for people coming out of treatment, we never would have built Alliance Apartments. So we did a little bit of language gerrymandering, if you will, to make it positive as opposed to negative. That works as long as we have Section 8 subsidy in place. It works as long as we have access to things like long-term homelessness. But if we get to the point where we have a subsidy where we're getting money directly from the Department of Corrections or as a result of something that is directed to corrections, to be used for housing, we can't very well not be open and honest with the community and say we're going to house offenders here. And we need legislative cover, political cover, and zoning changes and other things to be able to do that because it's the right thing to do. You know, it might run counterintuitive to people's ideas about public safety. It might run counterintuitive to their ideas about property values. We have all kinds of data that refutes that intuition. And we need to be able to have the political courage to say we're going to do what's right. That's my speech.
Are you going to rebut, Gary?
Well, I just want to say that what Dan says is absolutely true. We, with the Department of Corrections, have been essentially forced into using scattered site locations in order to get any kind of housing sited. And initially, we took kind of a low-profile approach to that. We learned, I think, a very valuable lesson down in Rochester, where we sited a location, had an uproar from the community about that site being where it was, without that neighborhood's approval. And we withdrew from that because we didn't want to be the bad guy here in trying to solve an issue that existed in that community. The fact that there was no emergency housing for offenders who were being released to that area. We went to a city council meeting and we discussed our housing program, and we asked that the policymakers down there consider how they wanted this done. If they wanted this resource, figure out how you want to do that and come back to us, and we will be very willing to cooperate in whatever way we can to give you that resource. And that's the approach now we're taking with any of these locations that we're citing. We want the community involved. We want to make it very clear to them that this is a public safety issue. We're not importing people into communities. Those people are already in those communities. What we're doing is providing supervised housing for those offenders and giving greater supervision to those people than any of the other people who are located in their neighborhood who have a criminal history. And I'll just tell you that we're very close right now to re-siting a location in Rochester with Rochester's assistance and changes to some ordinance language down there that allows us to actually site a location. I think the issue of us being unable to use public housing for our offenders is the reason we're in the housing business at all at this point. I would love to see some way for me to lose that particular job as housing manager for the department and to get that function back out where it does belong. And I do agree with Dan. I don't like the way you tax me every time you get the chance.
Well, Gary's the corrections person from the MHSA, though.
But in any case, I think right now we're providing a very valuable service to communities, although they may not want that service or really realize that we are doing something to supervise these people in a way that wouldn't happen if we didn't have this resource there. But I do think it's the first generation of housing for the Department of Corrections, and I want to emphasize first generation because I think what you heard from Sherry and from Pat here today is the next generation of housing we need to consider, and that is housing with supports, because these offenders right now are simply getting a place to lay their head, and there's many other issues that they have that aren't being addressed in any constructive, cooperative way, and we need to do that next.
And I'm not attacking you, Gary. I think you've done an admirable job with the limited abilities that you've been given.
I just wanted to throw one jab at you, Dan.
Yeah, that's okay.
I think the short of what we just heard was that there's a shortage. There's a shortage of housing.
Appropriate housing.
And so I guess in response to the question that is the biggest challenge at this point for housing for ex offenders is just the amount of it, there's a, you mentioned a whole host of other things, Dan. I mean the zoning and there's obstacles in our current Section 8 the way that's run and landlord. I mean there's all of those kinds of things, but. Is there any obstacle in the way that relates to a broader picture of the ex-offender. How many of them have the ability to pay if they could find a place? How many have the, you know, the what it takes to get a job, or how does it relate to all the other services that they need, you know, so that this could be kind of a pathway that could be a win-win for a landlord that wanted to get involved here, and for us as policymakers, and for the community. How can we make that happen? Ron, do you got your...
Mr. Chairman, I think one of the things that, and I know that the focus is housing here, but it ties into employment. I mean, employment ties right into it. The state legislature needs to take a look at the restrictions that the state of Minnesota has placed on these people. Mm-hmm. If you're a convicted felon, there are lots of jobs you can't do. I mean, the state of Minnesota can refuse to issue you a barber's license, a beautician's license.
I know. Assistant.
Salvage vehicle.
No,
person.
The homes program that we're running is carpenters. You don't need a license to be a carpenter, but you need a license to be an electrician or a plumber. And the state of Minnesota is saying, if you've been convicted of a felony, you can't do that for a living. Even if that's what you did before, I can take your license away from you. So the state's building barriers in here.
I think that's the committee, the collateral sanctions committee, is tackling that this summer. It's fall, I guess, in the fall now.
Yeah. And one of the recommendations or thoughts that I hope will be forwarded in that committee's report goes back to something that Commissioner Benson said, and that is we need to reduce the number of convictions. We have, the population of the state has not changed significantly over the last 20 years. The crime rate is pretty stable all that time, but the number of convictions for both felonies and misdemeanors has increased hugely, less in Minnesota than in non-guideline states, but it's still awful. In the sense that it's hard to see that it's functional, it's very expensive. And in the 21st century, we really are capable of determining risk at a level of safety that would allow us to have a mandated diversion program preventing convictions of people if they met certain conditions. I'm hoping that at some point we can get Rick Kern from the Virginia Sentencing Commission here, because he's a master of actuarial data. And they've come up with a tool, a risk determiner, that to 90%+ predicts whether people who are charged with felonies would reoffend. They use it, so it's a really good tool. They've got the cutoff at a really safe place. They use it to reduce prison commitments. As you know, Minnesota has done a very good job of keeping prison commitments per capita low. But we could use the same approach pre-conviction to prevent convictions in the first place, and then we might not have quite so much wreckage to deal with. I do think, too, that it's important not to overlook the impact that in our current data mining, data-happy society, not to overlook the fact that misdemeanors keep people from getting housing. Misdemeanors keep people from getting jobs. Arrests that do not lead to charges in some cases have the same effect. And so, you know, some of that front-end stuff, I think we could begin to get our arms around.
Just a question that I guess I've been curious about. Do we do anything in the area of incenting employers to hire ex-offenders?
There's a federal tax break that people are able to access. I believe the maximum is $1,500. If they hire an ex-offender, have them employed for 40 hours a week for a minimum of 6 months. And again, I'm not absolutely certain of the time. I know it's a full-time employment. But it's very cumbersome and difficult to access. There aren't a lot of employers that use it. I'm not aware of anything that exists on the state level.
I had a conversation with a union head of a man who used to be head of union trades, building trades, who suggested that it might be valuable to starting with the proposition that a lot of state-sponsored construction has minority set-offs. The program that Ron is talking about in Hennepin County, of those offenders, 70%+ were minority folks, as a matter of fact. And the building trades are having a hard time getting competent folks, you know, into that 25% slot. He suggested that it might be an incentive to employers if they could count an ex-offender against that quota, or if there were some such quota. And in many ways, you'd be killing two birds with one stone because you would be getting minority hires that way as well.
That's a federal program, though. It has to be done at the federal level, I believe.
Well, I think we could do something at the state level with state construction.
I mean, it would seem to me that employment and housing, I don't know if it's a chicken and egg thing. It seems like it has a relationship. You know, many landlords require some kind of a income verification, and if the category of people here that we're talking about of ex-offenders are not capable of making I think I saw someplace in here the homeless are making like $8 to $10 an hour, most of them. I mean, what you can actually look at and find for rental property in the marketplace is nothing. So you are basically limited to some kind of a government subsidized housing unit. And it would seem like somehow to break through that would be important. If there was a way that employers could begin to realize the benefit and the potential of ex-offenders as employees, so that there could be income, so that they could afford to go into the marketplace and apply for rent, or fill an application for an apartment, and have the income to support it. It seems like that picture has to start to happen, or else we're just going to kind of spiral into a subsidized housing policy for ex-offenders. And I'm not sure that that's where I think we should go. I mean, maybe we could discuss that a little bit.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think the other ingredient, and probably the highest priority, is sobriety. I don't know that you can hold a job or maintain a lease if you're not sober. So in the order of things, I think that, again, releasing people from prison sober, but, you know, we're really a small piece of this pie, too. So many of the probationers, and there's not a lot of money for treatment at that level. But if you're not sober, you know, what we see is it's only a matter of time before you lose a job, you don't get your rent paid, and you start into that downward spiral too. So I think those three priorities are all competing.
I have a fact that may be helpful for the working group, which is that these are long-term homeless statistics again, but we recognize that 25% or so of people coming out of corrections may have mental illness and chemical dependency and therefore may not be able, at least at that point, to become employed at a rate that would be able to pay for their housing and other expenses. And we know from the Supportive Housing Managed Care pilot and from other data from Minnesota Housing Funded programs that to house an individual with support services, people that need additional services, is about $10,000 a year. And to house a family with children that are unable to work and need support services is $15,000 a year. And if you compare that to the cost of incarceration or mental health institutionalization, detox, nights in county jails, emergency room visits, etc., it is far more cost beneficial, better for society, better for public safety, and better for those individuals and families to have housing with support services. And so I know that's just a portion of the population that you're talking about with offender housing. Some may only need an affordable housing opportunity. Some may only need help with first month's rent and a security deposit and some limited amount of supportive services. But there will be a large percentage, especially the people with serious and persistent mental illness, that will need ongoing support. It may not be permanent, but it is much more cost effective to provide them with stable housing and services.
I think we're going to try and wrap up at about 1:45. So, if we can kind of keep our and I'd like to give just a minute or two if there's anybody in the larger audience here that has an insightful thing that they could share with us in a minute or less. We'll give you a shot at that in just a minute here. So, go ahead. Somebody, you had
to, Chairman, just to follow up on that, if you turn to page 51 on that document that Terry passed out.
51.
Well, that's what it is on. On mine.
Oh, on this one?
This one. Yeah, I'm sorry, on the Lauder report.
The Lauder report.
I think it's even more of an issue than maybe she even indicated. I mean, if you look at it, 59% of those ex-offenders, serious persistent mental health problems. 70% with in- or outpatient mental health issues. 56% lived in a drug or alcohol treatment facility. Almost 70% have had outpatient drug or alcohol treatment. So the idea of these housing with services seems to me to be kind of attacking an awful big portion of the folks that we're looking at. And, from our own experience in the public defender system, our defenders will tell you, 80% of the clients they see come with chemical dependency issues, mental health issues, or both. I mean, that's just the way it is. So I guess to follow up on that, my question is, we talked about housing supply, but are the services, I mean, even if you had the housing available, are there enough providers and qualified providers that you could actually have housing with services, especially as you move out of the metro area? And that would, to me, to be a big question to answer.
And that raises an interesting issue. But
if you raise your hand, follow the rules, don't stop.
Okay. but we it's not like people are not getting services. Most of the people that we come into contact with, and I don't know how Sherry would relate to this or Pat would relate to this, but they're getting services somewhere. Most folks, they're accessing, they're accessing the welfare system, they're accessing employment, they're accessing child protection, they're accessing corrections, they're there, but somehow there's no real efficient coordination amongst those service providers to make sure there are places right now that provide services to the homeless population. Were we to give them homes, I don't know that there's any reason why they couldn't provide those services where they live as opposed to on a street outreach place. And I think that we need to explore that. We need to talk with them. I mean, one of the things we've gotten into has been housing development, and we've got good at it, and we've gotten, we've come at it from a service provider area. And, we did some housing on Central Avenue for a group called Mental Health Resources. And it was like, we have to find more services. And I said, no, wait a minute. You're already providing the services. You're providing them out on the street. You're providing them, in the homeless shelter. Why not just move the services over to the supportive housing project? And, a very little amount of new service money made a great impact. And it's coordinating those kinds of resources that are already out there, that they're already coming into contact with, that I think has to be one of our priorities.
Mr. Chairman, just in relation to this whole thing, I guess maybe a challenge to the legislature, or perhaps just a note to think about a little bit. I think we're spending about $28,000 per bed to keep somebody in prison right now. And, that's a lot of money. Am I right, Denny? About 28 grand.
give me 10 nonviolent property offenders and the $280,000 that you're spending to keep them in a cage. I'll have a caseload of 10. I'll pay myself $100,000 a year in salary, and I'll have $18,000 left for each of those 10 people per year to find them a place to live and to get them trained to do something. Now, that's $28,000, and we've got, what, 9,000 people in prison? How do we want to spend our money?
I mean, I don't disagree with you, but and it's interesting, though, that in the legislative process, we see all kinds of economic analysis about how much money we could save if we would do it this way. I mean, we could be making money if we were doing things right here. but it's a point well made. I mean, are we doing the most cost-effective thing? Let's just take a minute before, I just feel like there might be a person or two, and if you want to talk, I want you to come up and speak into the mic so we've got it. But, and I'd like you to keep your comment just to a minute or less. I mean, let's just take a comment or two if we have some thoughts from the audience before we are going to be done here. So I'd like to tell us your name, sir, and then make your comment.
My name is Guy Gamble, and I work for the Council on Crime and Justice in Minneapolis. And there's two things I wanted to talk about. You were talking about possible models where legislators could get involved with employment programs that would avail themselves of government subsidies. There's a place called the SAFER Foundation in Chicago, and they have a separate entity within their organization called the CARE organization. On the 1st of October, they're having their 6th annual conference. And that's a collaboration between state legislators, local policy mayors, makers, i.e. Mayor Daley's office, the SAFER Foundation itself, and I believe over 200 private employers now. And they've been able to combine the federal bonding credits that you can get for hiring ex-offenders with some state credits that you can get, and then Mayor Daley has also created additional local incentives. And that's been very effective in Chicago. The other place nationally that's been well recognized is the JOTF, Jobs Opportunity Task Force, in Baltimore, Maryland. And these two places provide great models where you can take the federal bonding credits, the local incentives, and state incentives, and have a broad-based coalition of people working together to employ ex-offenders. It's been very effective, right, Dan? You know about this. The other thing I wanted to comment on is this. I was happy that Commissioner Gomez brought up the misdemeanor issue. There's an interesting local illustration of just how bad that can be here. There's a Safe Zone Collaborative was set up in downtown Minneapolis almost 2 years ago. That was $750,000 jointly split between city, county, and the Target Center. Downtown Business Association. That reallocate between 8 and 22 law enforcement personnel to downtown corridor, downtown Minneapolis, Nicollet to Hennepin, for a 6-month pilot period. And that the net result of that was thousands of additional arrests, mostly misdemeanor offenses. Jerry Dreesen, who is the old CJCC coordinator for Hennepin County, did a wonderful report called The Downtown 33, the First 6 Months of the Minneapolis State Zone Collaborative. In that, it takes the top 33 livability offenders that were caught up in this net, and gives by demographics, by age, by mental health, by homeless status. 86% of these people had used a homeless shelter in the previous 12 months. 34% chronically homeless by HUD definition, 47% mentally ill, 31 of the 33 were African American. Total systemic costs for these people in the prior 12 months have been $3.74 million. None of them have been arrested for, they had, I think 16 of them had a felony history, but it was very often to be 8, 10 years ago. And then you look at multiple arrests for misdemeanor offenses. And it's shooting ourselves in the foot, really. So I think it's interesting to me to work on stuff. You can get state level policymakers bought into this stuff, and then you get down on the ward level in the city, and you start talking about reentry, and start talking about diversion programs, and they want to hang you from the yardarm if you go into that. I don't know how to breach that, but it seems to me that as you move ahead on the ex-offender issue, many of the ex-offenders started out as having multiple misdemeanor arrests. And a lot of that stems out of mental health issues, or stems out of chemical dependency, or stems out of substandard housing, or the lack of a good job. So I don't know. It's going to move the ball ahead somehow. That's why you guys are there, and I don't have to be. That's your job. Hey, thank you.
Thank you, sir. Thank you. Good. One other, want to make a comment? If we can just keep it very short, please.
Thank you, sir. I'll be very brief. My name is Jacob Reynolds, and I work at St. Stephen's in our ex-offender reentry program. And briefly, it is an honor to be sitting here in this room and to be part of a community that has leadership like this. That in a room where everybody seems to be on the same page to help ex-offenders, that just blows me away. I'd like to thank Gary Johnson and Dan Kane and all of you guys that are doing a lot of work in reentry. One thing that I didn't hear mentioned, first let me state that I'm an ex-offender. And needless to say, I've come a long way to be sitting here in this room with you guys. And not too long ago. And I work with ex-offenders on a daily basis, so I do have some insight, you know, as to what an ex-offender needs to have a successful reentry and a decent life. To me, that's a very important part. To have a good life. That's what I was striving for. And I made a commitment to do that while I was inside. I haven't heard much mentioned about cognitive models. For me, it was changing my thinking. And until I had changed my thinking, I would continue to see the world in the same way. And so, in prisons, they offered some different cognitive models that taught us how to look at the world and look at situations differently. You can put a horse and dress him up in different clothes, but he's still going to have a horse's thinking. We need to change the way ex-offenders think. And I know that Dan Kane and other people are doing that in the models that they work with, which is really important. But I think that following up and having a way to having real life people. I'm going to touch on my. I know I have a minute here, but I'm going to touch on my buzzword that I spoke with Senator Higgins about and everybody I come into contact with. But there seems to be a sentiment amongst the corrections community that one ex-offender can't work with another ex-offender, because if you do put two ex-offenders together, they might breed more ex-offenders. Okay? And it's a fear culture that exists. But let me say that there's other models out there, anonymous organizations such as Alcoholics Anonymous, that happen to believe that one alcoholic working with another alcoholic happens to be a model that works better than any other model. So I want to say that one ex-offender working with another ex-offender and showing him how he did it or she did it is a very effective thing. However, it's prevented on a lot of levels in employment. I know I have a lot of difficulty finding employment working with ex-offenders. But we kill two birds with one stone. We allow an ex-offender who's turned his life around to get a good job. And ex-offenders all of a sudden have a real-life role model to say, dang, look at him. He's dressed right. He's talking right. He's living right. You know, man, this stuff he's talking about might really work. You know? So I want to say that, and then financial planning also. I know I came out, I finally worked myself into a job as a plumber, and I worked myself into school, and then I worked myself into a house, or an apartment. And eventually I own property today. But I know that after spending 7.5 years in prison without seeing a paper dollar bill, all of my money was kept by the bookkeepers. I had no idea how to deal with money. It was you'd hand me a paycheck and I cashed it, and I was like, either it wasn't enough or what? Look at how much I have. So I think it's important that we look at, and I know that Hennepin County did recently pass some things that were to help with financial planning. When we talk about affordable housing, I just wanted to say that I work in housing. Okay, and the first question I have to ask the guy when he calls me up and says, Jake, I'm looking for housing, I'm an ex-offender, I have to ask him, what's your source of income? How much money do you make? And then they tell me I make $600 a month. And I tell them, I can't really help you. You know, I don't know of much housing out there for $600 a month. Well, I can get him a house, but he won't have money to eat, or he won't have money to do anything else in life. So when we look at affordable housing, they have some models called shallow subsidies and other models that say, you know, well, maybe we can't pay the whole rent, but maybe if we have a subsidy that allows maybe $150 towards rent. Now, all of a sudden, a $450 rent goes down to a $300 rent, and that becomes affordable to a guy. And then maybe we could phase those subsidies out as well. Like, you know, as they get working and as they get going, they can actually, you know, phase those subsidies back and do some other things. Thanks for your time.
Thank you. We're going to wrap it up today. I asked Melanie to come up with a tentative schedule, meeting schedule for the next, between now and Thanksgiving. And so I'm going to have you put these dates down, and then we'll confirm them later as if we can see that they work. But they're going to at least be the meeting dates we're going to work around. Would be the 3rd of October, that's 2 weeks from now, but all on Wednesday, the 17th of October, and then the 31st of October. I think we felt like, 3 to 4 to 5 meetings would be kind of the goal here, to get as much information gathered as we could, and then to try to have some time to think about how that we could craft some legislation that might get us started on the road here. So I think if we put those dates down, and then Melanie can confirm in email as we move forward. So the 3rd, the 17th, and the 31st of October, all Wednesdays, same time, 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Does that seem okay with most? Anybody have a closing thought here? Otherwise, if not, we're officially adjourned. Thanks for coming.